Welcome to the Leadership Labs with DeepRec.ai, a podcast where we delve into the fascinating world of deep tech entrepreneurship, company founders, and venture capitalists. I'm your host, Anthony Kelly, and I'm thrilled to have you join us on this exciting journey. In each episode, we explore the minds behind groundbreaking technologies, the visionaries who dare to push the boundaries of innovation, and the investors who fuel the growth of tomorrow's game changers.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's guest, Nina Patrick. Nina is an entrepreneur, startup mentor, and founder of a company called Memedo. In today's episode, we'll talk a lot about tech founders, what it takes to be a tech founder, a lot about the skills that Nina learned fast. I guess what I found really interesting to speak with her, she has a very good fail-fast approach, and she's able to fail faster than most, I hope you don't mind me saying, because she's learned sales, financial planning, strategy, and marketing, and none of those are a background, which is really interesting. So, Nina, look, great to have you here.
Awesome, Anthony. Thanks for having me.
Good. Look, first off, you've moved to Lisbon since we've last spoke about 6 weeks ago. What's happened? What's the plans behind that?
Yeah, I spent the last 4 years in Berlin, and I'm a native Californian, and I just was having a really hard time dealing with the weather. You know how the weather is in Ireland, so it's just gray all winter long, and I was seeking some sunshine. I was pulled to Lisbon because there actually is a big like Berliner community that kind of comes here to escape the winter. So spent the winter here last year and just fell in love with the city, the energy, the connectivity of the people. It's a much smaller community here, but still really thriving with entrepreneurship. And people are just really willing to share their connections. They hear your background and they're like, oh, I know who you need to talk to. I'm going to connect you right now. And that is a really welcoming energy and vibe to be around. Not to mention, you know, you're 20 minutes from the beach. You can go out on the weekend. You could go surfing and feel like you can really disconnect. It's a beautiful place. And I'm really happy that I made the move.
Look, hopefully it's something I can do. As I said, if I can ever get my girlfriend on board, Spain, Portugal, Gibraltar, Malta, any of them, right?
But yeah, start with just some small trips, and then she'll get some love for the place.
She does love the sun. She loves being away. I mean, who doesn't, right? That's now. Look, before we talk in about everything in between, why don't you sort of give us a little bit of a backtrack to your education, your career history, and what sort of led you down the path of being an entrepreneur?
Sure. So I started out as a bioengineer scientist turned entrepreneur. I have a PhD in drug discovery and development, like pharmacology and pharmaceutical science. And when I finished my PhD, I did that at the University of Arizona in Tucson, so another sunshiny place. I moved up to Silicon Valley and I started working for startups. The first company I worked for is called Prospect Bio. We bioengineered bacteria to act as sensors. I was the first hire there in charge of R&D. And we built this giant library of sensors that could detect different molecules, fragrances, and flavors. This was super interesting to Ginkgo Bioworks. We did a successful project with them, and they ended up acquiring the company and all the intellectual property in 2018. This really like demystified the founder experience for me, because the two founders were just like passionate guys in their 20s. They were like 26 and 27. I was the oldest person in the company at 28, and which is why it feels so wild.
How's Silicon Valley of
it? I know. Yeah. It's Silicon Valley. And yeah, exactly. It's just like exactly like the recipe. But they brought this thing to life, and we built it, and we did it, and somebody wanted it. And we kind of had that success, which was really cool. And we were using those sensors for just detecting different fragrances and molecules. And I thought there could be some applications for that into healthcare. And I wanted to start my own business kind of around that principle. But I was looking to get some of like the business boot camp, because I've been a scientist and now I don't know really what's going on over there. So I looked at different accelerators that I could join that could kind of like level up my skills there. And I joined Entrepreneur First in Berlin. At the time, they had three locations. They had London, Paris, and Berlin. Chose Berlin for the startup ecosystem. I knew that there was like a lot happening there. I had a couple friends that lived in Berlin already, so I felt like it was not so scary of a leap. I wanted to have a European chapter of my life because I feel sometimes that America can be very America-centric and not really look globally sometimes. Well, most times. And I wanted to see how other cultures approach the same problems and just kind of grow my own self personally and professionally. So landed in Berlin and ended up starting my company through the accelerator, and then just basically was on this like amazing journey for the last 4 years, building Mimito in a lot of different iterations. Like, we went through some pivots. We had a difficulty time doing certain sales and fundraising. We went through it all. And now I am mentoring startups, sharing that knowledge. I felt like I grew so many skills in those 4 years that I want to pass that information on to people. And now that's what I'm doing in Lisbon, and also helping, yeah, basically like being a little bit more operative in some startups as well.
Nice. Pretty insane. You mentioned, you know, being the oldest person in a Silicon Valley startup at 28. And look, mm-hmm. it's because you finished education. You went to do a PhD. Crazy to think that puts you as the oldest in a company.
I know.
But yeah, look, if we talk about it, right? So we'll talk about more specifically now on like the tech founders, what you've seen, what you've been learning as a tech founder, and then as a startup mentor, but specifically around like, let's say, personal skills, soft skills, what you see. Mm-hmm. And I guess, look, opening it up, casting the net quite wide, and I might know the answer to this one because you've semi-touched on it, but look, what's most important for founders, skill-wise, let's say, after having the application? So in your case, it was biotech. In some cases, if you're a deep learning person, you'll have a deep learning tech. Like, of course, these are going to be fundamentally what builds a product, but the skills around that comes next. What's up there in your opinion?
Oh, there's so many, but the first that comes to mind is understanding that you're building a product for a customer, and that customer sometimes isn't just a mirror image of you. And so this was kind of hard to get out of the box, because a lot of times I think we think we're like, but I built it and I like it, but that doesn't always translate into basically to the rest of the world. And so being customer centric and getting out from behind your desk, laptop, lab bench, wherever you're doing your work, and actually going and talking to who you think is probably your customer. So outside of friends and family who are going to pretty much praise whatever you do, and actually talking to somebody that's like, that is kind of the next level. And this was a really hard thing for me. I'm super outgoing, but when it came to this product, I thought, okay, it's a part of me. It's something that I put a lot of my effort into. And if somebody doesn't like it, that's going to hurt and be painful. But being open-minded and making those contacts and getting that feedback is so important. So one thing that the accelerator encouraged us to do, they were like, get on LinkedIn, reach out to people in your industry or that you think are going to buy this product, and get them on the phone for 10 or 15 minutes, ask them questions about how they're currently solving whatever problem your product is solving, and how are they solving it now? What are the problems with their current solution? Asking all of these questions so you really understand, is this a nice to have that you've built, or is this something that somebody's actually going to use and that they need and that they want right now? And so that was quite difficult, because you're kind of putting yourself out there, getting a bit scared, having these random conversations with people, but people are so nice. You send them a little note on LinkedIn and maybe give them a couple compliments, like, ooh, you're an expert in this field. I really want your opinion on something, on a project that I'm working on. And then normally people have 5-10 minutes. They're willing to get on a Zoom, and it's never 5-10 minutes. They always give you more time, and they answer a whole bunch of questions. And then they want to stay engaged. I'm like, oh, can I update you later? And they're like, of course, like, please, like, give me more updates on what you're building.
Yeah. I think there's getting the consistent feedback as well. But I also think there's a lot of where, as you said, this suits me, right? You know, this suits me. This is my age. I live in a certain town. I have this certain social mm-hmm. life, family life. This product is excellent. How many more of you are there? So also, funnily enough, it's got to suit a need, but it also can't be too niche. You need to attract
exactly
the market.
Yeah. Yeah. I think if you want to be a unicorn, it needs to be more like, it can't be super, super niche. But I would say don't discredit how many of me are there out there, because I think when you kind of boil down a certain persona and you're looking at a certain customer, you're actually like, all right, there's a lot of Ninas out there that, you know, like to listen to podcasts and want to be up to date on technology and have a certain salary bracket. There are quite a few, but it's a bit better to make sure that you're covering that whole customer group and not just the Ninas.
Yeah. And if we were to flip it and go the other way, what do you see? What do you see that they lack? So most important, understand who your users are, your potential customers. Where do you see them lacking in terms of skills?
So technical founders, I find they're so into the technology, and that makes a lot of sense. Typically, they come from a research background and they like answering research questions. And so sometimes answering research questions doesn't always build a product. And they'll also sometimes come with a technology that's looking for a problem. And this is super common. And quite difficult sometimes, because the way that all the startup handbooks, anything you read, is always going to say, find the problem first and then build the solution. But when you've been doing a PhD for 5 years and you're like, I've created this technology, this really has value, but you don't know who it goes to exactly. This can be quite a frustrating and iterative process, since you haven't kind of done it the other way around. And I see this quite often. And then the next one is kind of pulling those researchers out of the lab and saying, hey, we really need to go talk to the customers and make sure that we're building something that we can actually like commercialize and productize. And so I feel like it's kind of like the same skill. It's like kind of forcing them out, because it's completely out of their comfort zone. Putting themselves out there, getting on calls. This is like not at all what they're used to doing. They're used to putting all of their brain and all of their energy into their code or into their science or whatever it may be.
Do you think, I know it's hard to say, or maybe even hard to quantify, do you think almost not having a deadline or an end customer in research, if you're in a university, do you think that's, I don't want to say a problem, a hindrance, I can't think of like the right word, but it almost doesn't set you up for business success in a way?
Right. Not having a deadline is a huge thing to learn. And because when you're doing academic research, there's sort of like kind of always money available, and you could go down all these multiple directions and nobody's holding your hand. So no one's holding you to a deadline. I think maybe there are certain academic groups that work a bit differently, but I think generally this is the case. Mm-hmm. And so pulling a person out of that environment and then trying to get them to project plan and project manage is quite a new concept to them, and using tools where they have to communicate across a team, because usually they're used to working completely independently and then like presenting their results at maybe a monthly lab meeting. And that, when you now have to translate that into like a Gantt chart or using like Asana or Jira to manage your task and get visibility across the board, it's hard for them to chunk down what they do into smaller tasks and say, okay, this is probably going to take me 2 days and I'll be done with it then, and I'll be able to get you that thing. So yeah, maybe another one is, besides just kind of being able to see the customer, is learning that project management. And it would be a great skill for academic labs to start like incorporating into their planning to get more visibility, so everyone can sort of see how quick people are working.
Yeah, I mean, but some people get really passionate about research, right? And they're like, oh, there's a new source of data coming in that I can try out. There's a new tool that's coming in that I can try out. It might, and crazy enough, right? There, people in research are like talking about getting from like 95 to 97% accuracy up to 99 to 99.9. There's companies out there who are shipping products at 65, and they're like, "Yeah, we roll with it. We'll go from here."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see that a lot as well with like. Even in my company, we would want something to be perfect before we get it out the door. And I think there's a Reid Hoffman quote that says, if you're not embarrassed by your first MVP, then you launch too late. And that is something that like I kind of kept having to tell myself and tell my team, where it's like, just get it out. It's okay if it breaks. How many times have you opened an app and it doesn't work for some reason? And then it's like, oh, wait, we launched a bug fix. Here it is. Do the upgrade. And that's just how we're able to do that in software. Of course, on the other side, so going from a more biotech perspective, I had a diagnostics company, and this is not something we can ship without high accuracy. I mean, we see with the corona test, we see things that aren't accurate, but this is, I think there is some flexibility for inaccuracy, like 80% is acceptable for the COVID test. But overall, when you're dealing with people's health and you're doing things that are really much more serious, you have to adhere to a different set of standards. For the diagnostic itself, keep, you know, get as high accuracy as you can. This is where the researchers come, you know, their passion is really important, and the regulation and all of this around this. But on the software side, you can have some like interface problems and be able to fix those like as you maintain your app.
Call it better, right? It's our first version. Yeah, I wanted to then move on to and find out about how you've quickly upskilled and what you've learned. And I guess for me, one of the things that I really enjoyed when you told me about it, because it's not typical of what most people say, what they've learned in their first years of, you know, startup world, is finances, you know, how you've become really solid with that and understood it, you know, from a PhD drug development background to being a scientist in a lab to then entrepreneur force being your first experience, to now you would say you're quite competent and really understanding it. Like, talk to me about that experience, that journey, because it's quite daunting to a lot of people who, whether, as I said, it's a bioinformatics background, if it's a deep tech background, a software mm-hmm. background, it doesn't look nice. You know, you might understand code, but, you know, concatenate cells or whatever it might be in Excel to understand your finances might be your worst nightmare.
Yeah, it's super intimidating. I will not underappreciate that, because the first time I thought I was like, okay, I need to build this financial model, I just stared at this Excel sheet and looked like super clueless. I was like, I don't even know where to start, you know? And you're Googling like, what is cash flow? And you just feel like such a beginner. And it's not something you're used to feeling, because you're like, okay, I have a PhD. I understand deeply technical things. I am good at this. Here I am being a complete beginner. And I think I had to reintroduce myself to the material over and over and over again and iterate a lot. And honestly, it took me about 2 years to really start to feel comfortable with financial modeling. My first year, I was totally clueless. People kept sending me templates, and the template was so overwhelming. You had so many different tabs and each thing was linked. And, you know, there's these really beautiful formulas. But in the end, I had to just start from scratch. Like, I had to start with a blank Excel sheet and be like, all right, what are our expenses? What did we just spend for the last year? Let's just put that in. And what are our sales? What were our sales for the last year? Put that in. Who was buying from us? What type of customer? And you start to just get a bit granular, and it feels more real, because you're like, okay, we did spend money, and here's what we spent money on. It's great. It's super easy to model expenses. It's a little bit more complicated to model your revenue, because this is more unexpected. You can, you know, you put forth the most optimistic scenario, but sometimes different things change and you can get really complicated with it. But in the end, or I guess in the very beginning, you can be very simple. So you can just map out what you've done, look into the future. Typically they want like a 4-year forecast. So that's a bit sometimes daunting. Like, look into the future 2 years, see what that looks like with just your expenses. How many people do you plan to hire? And then also look, how were our sales before? How do we think our sales are going to go? What do we think is possible? And then circulate it with people in your network and ask them, does this make sense? Because if somebody else looks at your model and they don't understand what's happening, then you've created something that isn't that useful, because the whole point of it is to be able to share it and show people how you plan to spend money, how you plan to have sales. But I honestly had to build it from scratch. And then I ended up using quite a few resources from Slidebean. Slidebean is like kind of like the startup resource, like mega website. They have tons of pitch deck templates, financial modeling templates, and they have videos where they explain and go through their financial model template and take you and like show you what each of these things is for different industries as well. So for SaaS model, for a D2C model, for B2B, and you can look at how did they model that? What did they do? What factors are they including? And that made it super clear for me. But I really had to introduce it over and over and over again. And sometimes you complete your financial model and then you don't look at it for like 6 months or a year until you have to fundraise again. And then you're like, oh no. And so then you have to sit for honestly like a week or two. It is not something that you just sit down and do in 2 or 3 hours. You need to go into it, check out what you did, sleep on it, get new ideas, incorporate them, and kind of go through this iterative cycle.
Nice. I'm going to ask something probably a little bit more difficult. Startup company, no sales, say pre-seed, unfortunately, we'll have to forecast sales, in some cases up to 4 years.
Yeah.
And again, no sales experience. How should they proceed? What should they do?
So pricing and forecasting sales, I feel like, is one of the most difficult things to do. And I also think, coming from a technical background where we're used to doing things for free. I think as scientists, we kind of do things for the greater good, and we're not used to assigning value to certain technologies. Let's say we're like, oh, this should just be open source. This should go out to everybody. So putting a value on that is really difficult. And this is where you need to go talk to your potential customers. You have to understand, what are they willing to pay for this? And everyone kind of keeps it a little bit secret. So imagine you're trying to sell to a biotech company or big pharma. They're not going to exactly tell you what they're going to pay for their like enterprise SaaS that they use internally. You need to start to like network within this community. You kind of then start asking your friends and your colleagues, what do you think this would cost? And gathering as much info as you can to make a good estimate. And remember that the whole financial model is just a model. You try to get as accurate as you can, but you can't get 100% accurate. And everything, as long as you're making assumptions that have some sort of evidence behind them, and you could back it up and you can explain why you came to that assumption, then you feel free to put whatever number that makes sense there. And so I found that it was very hard to model like the frequency of my sales when I had no revenue. I didn't even know what was happening. And knowing like, oh, what if I get a big B2B customer? Like, how big of an order do I think they're going to place? And you just have to sort of rationalize things in your head. You're like, okay, it's a small company. Maybe they'll try and they'll buy 1,000 kits. And that's what this would cost. And they'll probably buy 1,000 kits every month or every 2 months. And so you model in that frequency. And then you can make a worst case scenario where you're like, okay, they buy twice a year. Or the best case scenario, they're buying every month. You can have all of those modeled out.
Bucketing your potential customers, and then you're justifying, I'm expecting 2A customers, 10B, 15C, here's the expected value per month, per year, right? And
exactly. Like, and even making it just like small company, medium company, large company. And then that's what you can just make 3 examples. So there's a lot of ways to do it. I really recommend like going to YouTube, going to Slidebean, seeing how other people have modeled other things, with somebody explaining it to you, because whenever you go through a financial model, you really should also be explaining it. Even when an investor asks me for my financial model, I'm like, cool, let's get on a call for 15 minutes and I'll walk you through it. Because if I just send it off to them, sometimes I'm like, oh, maybe they're not going to understand why I made that certain assumption, and I get the opportunity to explain it when I'm on the call.
Yeah, that's a good point. And then the other one you mentioned as well, you've managed to ramp up your marketing skills and how you show off. I mean, I found you through LinkedIn, so you must be marketing yourself pretty good for me to get you there. But yeah, how did you find that? Again, similar, coming from a science background, PhD, you don't market, you just assume people find you, right? And it's a very easy misconception.
Absolutely. I think this is super common with the if we build it, they will come, from scientists and technical founders. They're just like, oh, I'm building the best product ever. And once it's done, they're going to want it. And you're like, hold on, no. Like, before you even build, you need to figure out what that person wants. And so in marketing, this one is, I would say also, it's like, it was like a 2-year leveling up of skills. I ended up selling a D2C product. And so with D2C, you need to learn all about consumer marketing. I luckily had a really incredible advisor and mentor that taught me all about the different avenues that you could reach customers online. And he sat with me on several occasions and taught me how to use Google Ads, how to use like social media marketing, how to do Google AdWords, all these things that were completely, completely foreign to me. And now I find it, like you just said, I must be good at marketing. This is like, I like laugh at this because I'm like, I'm a scientist. I don't know anything about marketing. And I think there's honestly really small hacks that you can do to present yourself in a way that they're like, oh, okay, they know what they're doing. And honestly, one that I think is a little bit undervalued is just brand. And I was fortunate to work with a really amazing branding freelancer, and we rebranded Mamito, and it looked so good. Making a logo, spending time thinking about what our values are and how those values can come through in like a brand identity. And these concepts that I never heard of before. I never heard the word brand identity or any of this. And also, no, I guess my hack to everyone is only use 2 colors, like black and white don't count. And just don't use more than 2 colors. Like, honestly, use 1 color and look at some of the most famous brands around. And they're like, okay, they're black and white and red, or black and white and green. We had orange and blue, and white and black, basically. And then you can mix and match all those things together, and you can make so many versions of your logo, but it's all cohesive and it's simple. And then you make a brand guide where you're like, here are our colors, here are the hex codes, here are our fonts, send it to the team. And you're like, do not use anything else, and automatic. And then all of a sudden you have this like cohesive message that you're sending with the colors and the brand, even if they're a little bit different, if you have like the light blue and the dark blue. You can also use hues of the same color for emphasis sometimes. So you could we had orange and blue. So we had a little lighter orange, a little darker orange. But mostly you want to stick with those your core colors. And this, I feel like, has transformed a lot of the startups I mentor, because I'm just like, simplify it, pick your favorite 2 colors on that, or 1 color, and let's go from there. And then all of a sudden it's like, it's clean.
Yeah, no, I like that. Really, really good insights. A lot of stuff that I like that you mentioned around brand identity. Working with the right person has been really helpful, right? Because you understand what you want people to see. It's your vision. It's your mm-hmm. message. So creating that and creating it in a way that it communicates not only through you, through your brand, but then when you communicate it through your team, it's just as strong.
Exactly. I think another concept here to consider is like, you are creating also a brand for your target customer. And so in biotech, I find a lot of times that, I don't know, we always pick blue and black. It's just like across the board. It's always like white, blue, and black in biotech. But when you're selling within biotech, like, go look at like how is pharma marketing themselves, and then look at their concepts and bring that into your brand, because they're going to trust you because you look like them and you look like you sell to them. With D2C, it could be much more playful. Depends on your target market. And so we went with like a gender neutral theme, but we had planned 2 more color palettes for like male and female specific products as well. But yeah, overall, it's really important to consider your customer and what they're going to respond to. And so just going to all of your competitors' websites, your customers' websites, and seeing how they're doing it. And you're like, because you don't have to start from scratch. You can literally look to them, and they, especially these big companies, have huge marketing budgets. And so you're like, all right, they chose white and blue for some reason, so let's do it as well.
Nice. You've mentioned a couple of times where you've worked with people really closely. I guess you could call them coaches, mentors, advisors. Mm-hmm. You talk back on when you are founding, even from a marketing perspective, where you reach out to people on LinkedIn, talk to people about finances. So you clearly have a very positive experience with coaches and mentors, which I feel people don't do enough of personally. As I said, like in recruitment, I would be a bit of a thought leader. I hate to say that about myself, right? But I don't get reached out to by many people on LinkedIn. I am very happy to speak to people that reach out to me. I've reached out to people throughout my career, and it's played benefits to me. From you, what's been your experiences? I guess what makes you get over the initial, oh, what will they say, right? Because no problem for me. I'm a sales guy, right? I'm happy to face rejection square in the face.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that is, it's a learned skill, learning how to put up with, get all the rejections. I think going to your first question, like, I've had a lot of really good experiences with coaches and mentors. I've tried out a lot of coaches and mentors that didn't work for me as well. So it's a mixed bag. And then you stick with the ones that you're really resonating with and working really well with, that also are interested in what you're working on and want to give you a lot of their time. And I've been super lucky that I've been able to build these relationships over years. And now a lot of my mentors are now my friends, I feel. You know, we start some calls where we talk about life and we talk about what we've been up to, and then we dive into some of the hard problems. But I think sometimes when you are looking for a mentor or coach, you kind of put like this expectation on what they're going to deliver. And sometimes it just doesn't fit. Sometimes I think for founders too, we have our company is our life. And so sometimes you find these coaches that are like, I only want to help you with business, or maybe a therapist that only wants to help you with life. And those things are so intertwined, and so you never turn your brain off about the business. You're thinking about it all the time, and being able to find the right people where you can talk to about both of those problems, because they weave into each aspect of your life. Like, I can't bucket them separately and be business Nina and personal Nina. I am always the same person, and these things come together. So finding somebody that could help me with those kind of the founder life problems, this took a lot of iteration. And I ended up asking a lot of my founder friends, who do you use? Who do you recommend? And if they found somebody that they really love, then I would go and try and get into their client base. For specific things like marketing, brand, financial modeling, typically it is also through my network where I find a lot of people. I've had other people introduce me to people, just say like, oh, you should definitely talk to this person. They're really good at marketing. And then it's worked out. So lean into your network. Write people on LinkedIn, ask them for 10 minutes. You never know if it'll turn into like an actual mentorship relationship, because they also have to like what you're working on, I think, because then they're like, oh, I'm willing to spend a lot of time to get this person to like level up, especially somebody with a technical background that is going to just take more time. And so many times when I've had to ask people over and over, I'm like, I know you explained this to me, but I still don't get it. And can you walk me through it one more time? Or I totally forgot, like, what was the flow that you did? Like, break it down, like, show me again. And you have to really humble yourself and be able to say, like, you know, very openly, like, I'm still not getting this. And can you take the time to show me again?
Ah, really, really love that. It's something I've spent money on coaching. I've reached out to my network, to people who I always thought were better than me. Throughout my career, it's excelled my career. I'm a big fan of it. I'm also quite passionate about content, right? I listen to the High Performance Podcast, Diary of a CEO. I listen to sales podcasts, recruitment podcasts. I like to see how other people podcast, right? There's that element of it as well. I like to see how people are developing mm-hmm. communities. That's what I aspire to do too. Was there any sort of content that you really used as well, outside of mentorship, that you found helpful?
Oh, I think I've read every startup book out there. So everything that's on like this, I should make this the startup reading list. I'm sure it's out there. We could Google it and find it. I read every single book, because in learning from, you know, just learn from the best, learn from the people who have done it. They may have done it a different way than you. And if you get a chance to talk to people who have done it, talk to them, ask them a ton of questions. And normally they're like, they'll start a conversation with like, how can I help? And a lot of times I would just be frozen. I'm like, I don't even know how you can help me. There's so many things I need help with. But also, if you just start that conversation with like, here's the stage we're at, we don't have any customers, we're still building, then they can understand, oh, I know what you need help with because I did that back when I was at that stage. In terms of content now, because I'm writing my newsletter where I write about longevity science and psychedelics, which are both passions of mine, kind of a knockback to my PhD where I was doing work in epigenetics. With this, I just consume a lot of science content. So I'm a big fan of the Huberman podcast. I also listen to Ologies by Ali Ward. She dives into any type of science and she's so enthusiastic and silly. And it sounds like she's just like your best friend when you listen to her. And teaching me how should I present my content in my newsletter? I obviously also look at like Morning Brew, The Hustle, just for their stellar newsletters, not necessarily my niche, but just how do they lay it out? How quickly do they make a point? And just like go learn from the best, consume as much content as you can from those people, and then try to put your own spin on it, but also like, you know, look to their structure, template the way they do, and add in where you can add in your own personality that's going to pull in your readers or your listeners because they're here to listen to you for because they like you.
Yeah, I do also feel if any content is extreme, like massive followership, right, there's an element where they've went through and paid someone for marketing to understand how these things should be done best, right? So if you can copy, yep, their content delivery strategy, you probably copy in what's cost them a couple of €1,000.
Yeah, exactly. And it works, and they're proving that it works. And if you see that somebody made a drastic change for some reason, it's like, ah, okay, they made that change because this wasn't working. And if you can then reflect that in your strategy and how you lay things out, I think, yeah, there's a huge benefit to just copying, emulating, translating that into your own style. Absolutely.
I think that also, just for anyone, it's not only if you're thinking about newsletters, podcasts, relating it back very similarly to your customers' websites, your competitors' websites. Always want to be checking these sort of things as well as sort of like growth strategies and growth plans.
Exactly. Yeah.
Want to ask you, I guess just real quickly about leadership. Again, I know you mentioned one of the first employees, so that ultimately comes with its own leadership problems, strategies, scaling problems, but then also Manito, again, leadership, growing, scaling. What did you find was the most difficult part of being a leader?
I always think it comes down to communication and finding the right like communication frequency and what works with your team. I've tried so many different things from kind of going like pulling from my PhD where it's like, do we need to just have like a weekly lab meeting? Everyone hates those because they really were awful in grad school. And so we're like, oh no, we don't really want to do that. Where one person presents each week, it's like, this doesn't work. I've also tried daily stand-ups where everyone for 5 or 10 minutes just tells me what did they do yesterday? What are they planning to do today? I felt that got too granular. I started doing once a week planning meetings where we just planned the week. Like, here's the sprint for the week. And this was the best. So just getting everyone on the call, everyone kind of puts their tasks into, we use Jira as our project management tool. And so you get visibility of what everybody's planning to work on and what's in the backlog and how that's going to fit in like the upcoming sprints. Then you have something that people can keep going back to when they need to be reminded, what was I supposed to work on this week? Or, oh, I forgot that I also committed to getting that done. That was the best element, and that we could do in about an hour or 90 minutes with the whole team. We were still quite small, so we were able to all be in the room always. At the largest at Prospect, we were 12, and at Mamito, we were 4. So we were, I'm used to very, very small teams. I think when you get to 12, you need to start segmenting out a bit. And then when you get to 25, that's when you really need to start to kind of create some different strategies on how you talk to the different teams. But that was, I think, that was our best tool. And we needed that because we ran the company all through COVID. We had to go through kind of switching from seeing each other every day in the lab to remote work and not everybody coming in anymore. Some people being in the lab, some people not. But in the end, we found a system that worked for us. But I also really recommend one-on-ones with your direct reports. So for me, that was the whole team. So I was always doing a half hour with everybody once a week. But as you create more layers as a CEO, like you need to get the information from your direct reports and then they can get it from lower. It's also important to skip level. Sometimes you want to check in with people below the people you're interfacing with to make sure that you're getting a good viewpoint of that as well.
Yeah. No, that's good. I like that. It's something that I'm still working on, the communication, right? I've been managing for about 3 years now. Still don't think I've cracked it. Like you, missing a couple of tricks. Daily stand-ups, probably too much. I agree. We do a weekly setup. But then I believe after everyone sets their goals, have we probably created a nice formulated process to that if I'm not available or someone isn't there, is there a go-to place where they can say, right, I'm really struggling with X problem. In here, we actually have a very descriptive way. If you face X problem, this is how you solve X problem. Also, leaves elements for innovation in there as well, right? Because if they can solve X problem, oh, do you know what? They're too busy. I won't ask them. But if they get really stuck, they have a place to go. But other than that, they might find a quicker, faster, better performing way to do it, right? I think that's important too.
Yeah, exactly. That can be super empowering. Obviously, if you're like super blocked for whatever reason and you can't move forward, that's also very frustrating. But yeah, for us, I was probably a bit too available on Slack. I was always available on Slack. So if somebody ran into something, some blocker like this, I'm just like, okay, let me unblock you. I also had to sometimes, like, you know, you want to hire people into your company that are better at you than some, like better than you. And in sometimes when we were pretty budget conscious, we had to hire in more junior people. And I had to hold myself back from being like, okay, I'll just do it because it'll be faster, and let them do it their way, and then give them feedback and make sure that you're kind of shaping them to level up when they can.
Yeah.
And this is something I think a lot of managers, CEOs experience, because you're used to doing everything yourself. Now all of a sudden you have this other person that maybe is not better than you right now, and you have to be patient with them and still give them the time to learn and develop those skills and become better than you.
Yeah, I think I touch on it quite a lot. I think I call it creating a safe learning environment, right, where they're in that time, they're not, it's not the 1980s, right? You're not going to get fired for getting it wrong. But they're also in a way safeguarded. Like, it doesn't, if it's something, you don't ship the software straight to a customer first, right? There's steps, there's review processes, there's check-ins.
Yeah.
And it's creating that learning environment. And with the younger generations and that people who've just come out of college or university or whatever it might be, this is how they develop. And ultimately, me working in the HR recruitment domain, I know this is also what makes them happier. This is what leads to longevity in their careers, better staff retention. Funny enough, increase in innovation, because they know, oh, do you know what? I know Nina's not gonna fire me if I make a mess of this, but I'm gonna give it my best shot, right? And these are all in that creating the safe learning environment, I guess, as I like to call it. What about skills that you didn't have, but you really improved over your time as being a leader?
This one's more difficult to answer, because I think sometimes as a leader, we don't necessarily see ourselves as a leader sometimes. Like, I still think of myself as I'm just part of the team, or I don't realize that people are looking up to me as a leader, maybe like on LinkedIn or as a thought leader in these sort of scenarios. You're just like, I'm just putting myself out there and I'm trying to be as genuine and as authentic as possible. And so you're like, wow, people think that's some type of leadership. And you're like, oh, I didn't realize that I was like honing these skills. Most of the time, it's like, I look to my mentors and I look to the best people I see as leaders, and I try to emulate what they do. I'm like, oh, in that situation, they handled it with grace and they handled it with kindness and they were patient, or whatever it was that they did. And I'm like, I want to act like that as well, because I felt like I was respected and treated well in that exchange. So then I try to do that as best as I can. And then hopefully somebody sees that and they're like, oh, wow, she kept her cool. She didn't lose her, you know, she didn't lose like and get angry and lose her temper. But you sort of, I think it's like, you think about it, cause it's a lot, it's like accumulation of soft skills, which you can't just necessarily go read not read a book or take a class, but you sort of have to see people demonstrating it for you to understand like, oh, that's how I could apply that.
Yeah. Oh, that's nice. So you've done it quite a few times, you know, you've lived from the PhD world into the startup world, not something that people generally make that direct movement from, right? It's some people take a little bit longer than that. They go corporate, they move in slowly, but I guess you've seen it. You've been startup mentor.
Yep.
what, where'd you get your inspiration from? Like you're in the fastest paced environments. You could argue it and say it's also the most stressful environments. But you've continuously went back. What keeps you ticking?
Oh, I think this is the problem with entrepreneurship. And this is why you have serial entrepreneurs, because once you do it once and you realize, you feel so empowered. You're like, I built something that I brought into the world and I sold it. And I want to do that. Like I have other problems I want to solve and I want to do it again. And it's so exciting in the early stage where it's quite chaotic and I think that you really get addicted to it. But okay. So going from PhD kind of into the startups. So a point I want to make there is in my PhD, we only talked to like, you would go to these kind of like professional development workshops and they would talk about two career options. They would talk about industry and they would talk about academia. Like these were the only things in the world that you could do. And I found this so frustrating. I was on like the graduate student council and one of the initiatives I wanted to bring forward was like, we need to introduce all like other career paths to the students, because it's not just pharma. For me, it was just pharma or academia. And really in the world, it's like, how many people are professors? Like such a small amount of people are professors. So this is not even like a viable career path for most people. So I ended up sort of doing some research, asking around, going to LinkedIn, reaching out to people in my community that had kind of interesting jobs that were sort of somewhere in the spectrum, you know, in government or in medical writing or in startups or, you know, biotech, different things along that scale, and bringing those people in to speak at our like student seminar. And I felt like this was super eye-opening to a lot of students because they didn't even think that they could start a company. They didn't even know what commercialization meant. And seeing, oh, we could actually do a startup, like, oh, I might actually be doing something worthwhile with my research that could be applied. Like a lot of the researchers in my department were doing basic research. So it's really kind of a long way away from being translational sometimes. And so seeing that kind of light up in their mind and they're like, oh my God, I can actually maybe do a startup. So then I got really into startups because I just felt like there was a cool energy. Obviously, you know, you see the headlines about founders and all this success and you kind of think they're, I don't know, covered in glitter or something. They're like superhuman in a way. And I moved up to, you know, the Mecca for startups in San Francisco and found just a really cool startup with really passionate founders. And I had a really good experience there. And even the team, like the whole prospect team, we're still in touch with each other. And we, you know, we wrapped the company in 2018. I still go and see them when I'm in San Francisco and everyone's working on really cool stuff. Everyone's gone really cool places since then. Yeah. But yeah, I think it's like, there's a bit of an addiction to the chaos. And I also think, I mean, I have a huge appetite for risk. So I know I'm very unconventional in that regard. And I think as an entrepreneur, you have to have like this incredible risk appetite where you're like, I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to pay myself this month. What does that look like for me? And then realizing that like, okay, what is the what is the worst thing that could happen? And being able to get yourself calm about what that worst case could be. And, you know, worst case scenario is I fail. And that's, most people don't even try. So I'm going to have learned a lot and being able to take that into my next thing too.
Nice. Was it Warren Buffett or Henry Ford? Someone has quite a famous quote about the working system and the education system. It doesn't build entrepreneurship, it builds employees. And it's purposely done that way. I can't remember who it was, but there is one out there like that. And I mean, it just shines through. Like, obviously something that I'd never grown up with, grown around and gone quite down a different road now myself.
Yeah, it's not fostered at all. I agree with you. It is a system to breed employees. And when you try to break that mold and when you try to go and say, hey, I'm going to start my own thing, you get met actually with a lot of, I would say,
doubt.
Not always helpful feedback. Yeah, a lot of doubt. And people are like, ooh, why would you do that? Yeah. Are you sure it's going to work? Like, why would you go, like, even when I started working for startups, it's like, why would you go work for a startup? I can't believe you're doing that. And there were moments when, you know, we'd be in a fundraising round and I'm like, I'm not sure if we're going to be able to fundraise. Like, I might not have a job in 6 months. And they're like, what? Like, how are you dealing with that? And you're like, I mean, this is what I signed up for. I would be really naive to say that I didn't know that this was a possibility. And I still, when I have an idea, like, sometimes talk to the wrong people and they're just not very encouraging. You need to surround yourself with the people that are going to cheer you on, even if that means like separating yourself from certain people. It's like, you need the people that are so supportive, love what you do, love who you are, and just keep you going when things are super hard. And they're like, if this is your passion and this is what you want to build, like, I am here to lift you up. And let those people that are giving all that negative talk, like, let them hate like somewhere else, far away from you.
Good. Look, we're getting on with this. Are you ready to take on the quickfire questions?
All right, yeah, let's go for it.
Nice and easy. We already spoke about books, content, podcasts that you liked. What one would you recommend to other aspiring entrepreneurs?
Okay, my favorite book of all time for entrepreneurship is by, I think it's like Bill Alluitt. Maybe I'm pronouncing it wrong, but it's called Disciplined Entrepreneurship. It basically takes you through like the 24 steps of how to start a company. And it is my go-to like reference guide. Then my second one I really like to recommend is The High Growth Handbook by Illid Gill from Stripe. This is also like, it's a guidebook. It's a handbook. You can read like how he did it, how he recommends that you do it for like step-by-step in like a super high growth environment.
I talk about your three non-negotiables when it comes to leadership, entrepreneurship. They can be non-negotiables you set yourself, non-negotiables, I guess, you set as values for people to work with you. What would you say your top three are?
So, okay, top three is like you need to be open-minded and have an appetite for risk. And the third is like a willingness to put yourself out there and get rejections. And one rule I have there is like, there's one of my advisors told me like, you need to cross 10. So you need to do something 10 times before you can say that it failed or it worked. So if that's talking to 10 customers and all 10 say no, then you're like, all right, probably this is not my customer group. But maybe on number 9, you get a yes. And you're like, okay, we got to do another 10. Then we have to see if this is going to hold true.
Good. And last one, arguably the most difficult question I'll ask you today. If you were to do it all again, what would you do differently?
This is a harder one to answer because I would do everything differently. Because now I know so many things. I did everything possible in certain ways and wrong. But what I've learned now is I can build something and like launch it so much faster than I could in the past. So you mentioned the very beginning process with rapid prototyping. I now, if I have an idea, I'm like, okay, let's buy the domain. Let's get a landing page up. Let's do it in about like 12 hours. Let's circulate it with some of my mentors and former employees, see how they feel about this idea. And if it doesn't catch, then you're like, okay, I only invested 12 hours into this thing. As opposed to before where I'm like, oh, it needs to be perfect. We need to make sure that everything looks super good. The pitch deck is perfect. It's like, just start with something that you can then show to other people and get feedback as quickly as possible. And that is the 100% thing I would have done differently. And everyone tells you to do this, but the first time you do it, you're like, oh, I don't really understand. Because rapid to a next PhD means 6 months, but rapid now to me means, yeah, like an afternoon.
6 hours.
Yes, like 6 hours. I mean, just getting an idea down on paper is so transformative, because as you're putting that into reality, you realize all of the gaps and all the things you need, all the information that you need. And then you're like, okay, cool. Let me go talk to those people and try and fill those gaps. And along the way, if those 10 people I talk to think that this is a horrible idea, then we can, you know, I can start to iterate on it and get it better and then come back and ask again.
Nice. Love it. And that does us for time, Nina. It's been an absolute pleasure. I've loved the chat, and look, it's been an absolutely cracking conversation.
Cool. Thanks, Anthony. I really appreciate being invited and enjoying the conversation too.
And that concludes another enlightening episode of the Leadership Labs podcast. If you found today's episode thought-provoking and informative, be sure to subscribe to the Leadership Labs on your preferred podcast platform or on YouTube. Thank you once again for joining us on this journey through the Leadership Labs. Until next time.